Good morning and welcome to The Morning Voice. I am Dr. Ed Ackerley. With me in studio is my brother Bill and our CEO of our company, Ackerley Advertising, Morgan Murphy. Good morning, Morgan.
Good morning.
Well, this is a bittersweet day for me.
Yes.
You are graduating next week.
And I am.
This is your last official session with us here on The Morning Voice as the CEO of Ackerley Advertising. You're going to switch and become a multi-bazillionaire and go out.
Of course.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
I have no idea yet. The world is my oyster, I guess. There's so many options, which is exciting. It's a good thing.
Well, you got an engagement ring on your finger, which means you and your husband-to-be are planning a wedding eventually here.
So. Yes, yeah.
And you've got about 16 jobs that you do right now. You might pick one of those and be good. And you're not going away. We're going to try and hoodwink you in to come and be part of this every once in a while, so... But officially, thank you for what you've done for
of course
the Ackerleys and for the Morning Voice, and you've been fantastic. You're our number one intern this semester, so we want to thank you. You've been fantastic, and we really appreciate all you've done. This is Success, where we talk about the good things going on in Tucson, and that all comes about from when I ran for mayor. People would pin me against the wall and want to tell me all the terrible things that were going on in Tucson and government and so forth. And once they got that out of our system, they started telling me why they lived in Tucson, why they came to Tucson, why they stay in Tucson, what they love about Tucson, and why they have a business here or whatever. And I always thought that was always the more compelling story of people love this community and love being here and love the good things that are going on. So I was at the beautiful Arizona Sands Club not too long ago enjoying an event. And some person just walked up to me and said, "Howdy ho." And I said, "Howdy ho" back. And here you are. You're on the show. Welcome, Dr. Paula Rivadeneira. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me today.
And you go by Dr. Paula, so I'll be calling you that. You're with Choya Afterlife. And so it was happenstance that we met, but you have an intriguing story. You were telling us that story, and I reached into my pocket and grabbed my card and said, "You need to tell that story on the air. This is pretty awesome." So we'll talk a little bit about your University of Arizona involvement in a little bit, but tell us a little bit about your background and what inspired you to start something called Choya Afterlife here in Tucson.
Sure. So a long time ago when I was in grad school, I opened a pet sitting business. I was in Opelika, Alabama, went to Auburn for my PhD, and a lot of my clients started calling me and asking me to take care of their sick animals, even when they were not out of town. So I realized that I really had a good connection with animals who were older in years, maybe a little sick or special needs. And so over time, I ended up opening a nonprofit called Old Souls Animal Rescue and Retirement Home, where we take in geriatric special needs and hospice animals. So obviously, they pass away more frequently than, you know, in regular families. And I really hated handing them across the counter to someone when it was time for them to pass and be cremated. And so I didn't love the experience. I wanted to be a part of that next step. I wanted to be the one that took them all the way to the end and had their powdered remains and knew they were mine. And there was an instance early on where I don't think I got my pet's actual remains back. The paw print that I received looked like a generic paw print. It definitely wasn't the paw print of my cat. Mm. And because of that, I thought, you know what, I'm going to do this. I am going to open a crematory. And it ended up that I went to this conference called International Association of Pet Cemeteries and Crematories just to explore the idea. They had one talk about aquamation, which is water cremation. And I said, "That's it. I'm in. That's what I'm opening."
That's great. And so you call it Choya Afterlife? Is what
I do.
It? Right.
Yes.
And so it's really, as you describe it, and as you described it to me the other day, it's really about compassion, is it not? And about the bond between the animal and the human being and the human family. And, you know, pets become part of our, become part of us. And if you think about it, they wait all day long for us to get home and be part of their life. And
they
yet,
sure do.
We had golden retrievers. We had five of them. And the two boys specifically, they would come when I got home, they would follow me around the house the rest of the night and sleep by the door to make sure that we were okay. And it was just amazing how I think they actually knew more than we let them know, than we think they know, whatever.
Definitely, I agree with that.
So you have this interesting thing. Well, I know somebody that has a cat name, Kimchi.
Yes.
Who she just spent $9,657,822 on. And I said, flippantly, honestly, I'm not trying to be rude here. I did say, why don't you just leave the back door open and let her go?
But, I know. That's what was my reaction too.
I did say that because she spent several thousand dollars to take care of a cat that someone handed to her when she was moving, helping to move one day. And now she's got this cat that's part of their little family that's pretty special to you, right?
Yes, I've had her for 5 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she needed some care, and you took her to the vet. And
teeth are an expensive thing to fix.
They sure are.
A couple thousand dollars later, you are you love her even more now. You're invested in her now, as they say.
Oh, I've been invested. There's another thing, so.
Yeah. So, you know, it's an investment, and I'm just trying to be silly here, but it's an investment of time, effort, love, and money to have a pet, and so it becomes an important thing. And so I was intrigued when you were sharing this story with me about what aquamation is and how it works. And we don't need to get too graphic here, but what is the difference between using a normal, what people would normally think what cremation is, and using aquamation? If you can kind of just give the difference between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. So the traditional cremation is done with fire.
Mm-hmm.
My process is called aquamation. It's alkaline hydrolysis. It's done with water. And so what happens is it actually uses up to 90% less energy than traditional fire cremation. Mm-hmm. And there's no harmful emissions or anything like that. It's water in, water out.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is once we have that pet, it's like their last bath. Actually, mm-hmm. It doesn't use up a lot of water. It's really as much as you would use in a bath. So they go into a cradle that goes in a machine that literally is a big bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
And I put alkaline in there, and that speeds up the process. So it's very similar to what would happen to your pet if you buried them. It just really speeds up that process.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, people often say, well, how will I get ashes back? And so you don't get ashes per se. We call them powdered remains.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the process, all that's left are your pet's bones.
Mm-hmm.
And so I dry those and turn those into powder, and that's what goes in the urn, and you get to take home with you.
So you do have an urn, and like you say, it's a little bit more sensitive to the environment, and some would even suggest it's even a little more sensitive to the actual animal themselves. That they're used, perhaps, maybe especially a dog, for instance, used to taking a bath, and that's kind of okay with them. They're not really used to running through a fire pit or anything like that.
And yeah, so, not so much.
Yeah. And so that kind of creates this different kind of a perspective on treating them, like as you said, all the way to the end.
And absolutely. And we do treat them like they're alive when they come to us.
Mm-hmm.
With all the love, all the respect that they would get when they were alive. We talk to them. We introduce them to the other animals that are going to be in the machine at the same time, even though everyone is kept 100% separate.
Right, right. So as you describe this and as you talk about this, you talk about this being about dignity, grief support, and personalized care. Can't you get that from a crematory and a regular cremation service, or from a pet cemetery where they bury them in the ground? What makes you different in this regard?
Yeah, I think in our industry in general, the people who are involved are compassionate humans, right? They want to do what's right. They want to help people. For me, it's the gentleness of the process that I really like a lot. It's not like a washing machine. It's literally just gentle swirling water around them. Whatever position I put the animal in, that's the position their bones are in when they come out. And so I feel like that is very gentle and peaceful and respectful. And then another thing that I do that I don't know what the crematories do, but what I do is I have a special ceremony that I do when people bring their pet to me. It's called a sprinkling. And I have them sprinkle their pet with dried flowers and herbs, and they rub it into the parts that hurt that pet during life, so they can have a safe journey to the bridge. And then those flowers don't dissolve. They don't decompose in the machine. So they also get dried with the pet's bones. And that way I can make that part of the powdered remains that they get back. So it's like a little bit of their family gets to go with them.
That's very interesting. We're speaking with Dr. Paula Rivadeneira from Choya Afterlife. And she provides aquamation for final preparation of a pet, a loved pet, for eternity, I guess. When someone comes to you, to be honest with you, when you were describing this to me the other day at the Arizona Sands Club, I was a tad taken aback by it, like not really understanding exactly the science behind it and how you do it. But as I've heard you talk about it, that night when you were talking, explaining it to other people, and even here this morning, it begins to make a little bit more sense to me. How do you talk to people about, here are your options? You can bury them in a pet cemetery. You can have them in a regular crematory and have them do normal cremation. Or this is the other option, aquamation. How do you help pet owners decide which one is best for them?
So usually by the time they get to me, they've made that decision. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they call, though, and they say, oh, you know, I saw you. I Googled you. I saw you. Can you please explain it to me? So I pretty much explain it exactly the way we talked about and explain how compassionate we are. And just explaining the process and how gentle it is, I think really helps people. The other thing is that I'm the only pet aquamator in town where your bodies actually stay here. Your pet mm-hmm. isn't going to leave Tucson. You know, there are other companies where the bodies get taken up to Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And I just, for me personally, I would not want my pet traveling in the back of a van anywhere else. I want them here local. And so that's another deciding factor for them, is that I am a local business. All of us work here, live here. We are their neighbors, and right. we love their pets as much as they do. And so that's exactly what we want them to feel, is that we're taking care of them as much as we're taking care of their pets.
Great. We'll come back after the break and talk with Dr. Paula from Choi Afterlife about this unique service that she provides to families of loved pets. And we'll talk a little bit more about her work at the University of Arizona. You're listening to The Morning Voice on KVOI. We'll be back after some words from our great sponsors. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. Coming up Monday, Lydia Randa has Rainmakers. On Tuesday, General Ted Maxwell will be here with an engagement hour. On Wednesday, happy birthday to Grant Kruger tomorrow. His Wednesday show is Food for Thought. Good job, Grant. We appreciate all you do for us. You're 1 year older. Tom Moulton on Thursday, and we do Success and Wonder at the U of A on Friday. Morgan Murphy's been with us for quite some time, one of our fill-in hosts who helps us when we have someone out of town or whatever, is Alan Kaith. Good morning, Alan.
Ed, good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I appreciate all you do for the Morning Voice and the Ackerley family, but you wanted to do something special to Morgan since this is her last official show, so take her away.
Morgan, good luck with your new job as the official spokesperson for Pope Leo.
Oh, thank you.
We're going to miss you, Morgan. You did a great job, I know, for Ed and Bill, but also when I would fill in for them. I appreciate what you did, and I just wanted to thank you personally, because I probably won't get to see you before you... Oh, are you going to leave town?
I'm not sure yet, but thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun. I've learned a lot, and I enjoyed working with everyone. So
I just got to find $10,000 a month to pay her to keep her here in Tucson. So,
well, that shouldn't be a problem, Ed. Also, Ed, I have a question for your guest.
Yes, fire away.
I hope it's not. By the way, Grant, happy birthday, Grant Kruger. 21 years and holding.
Yeah, exactly.
Dr. Paula, I'm sure you do a wonderful job with pets, but have you heard of this for people?
Yes, they actually do this for people. In fact, Desmond Tutu was aquamated.
Wow.
Yeah, and it is legal here.
Do they do it in Tucson or Phoenix? Do they do it in Tucson or Phoenix?
I don't know of anyone yet that is doing it for humans in Arizona, but it is legal to do here.
Interesting. Interesting.
That's my question. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Thanks for checking in with us. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Have a good weekend, Ed and Bill.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you. So we are talking with Dr. Paula Rivadeneira. Rivadeneira is what I meant to say. Rivadeneira. Rivadeneira. That's how you say it. With Choya Afterlife. And so this aquamation that you do, what Alan was referring to, is to take a loved pet and instead of burying them in the ground or putting them in a normal fired cremation system, you put them in water and they come out as powder, and you have a, just like you would put them in an urn on your fireplace mantle, that's what you get. So so talk a little bit about how this honors that human-animal bond. You kind of wove that story of how this is really important for the loved animal and how it kind of respects that bond.
Yeah, I think the human-animal bond is so tight, sometimes tighter than human to human.
Right.
And this is, I feel like you know, this is the last thing that people are going to have and remember about their pet. So I want it to be really beautiful and special and personal. And so that's part of why we do the sprinkling ceremony. We want them to really feel like they've got closure. I know when I was a child, I did not get closure for my dog. Mm-hmm. And so I encourage people to bring their pet to me or let me pick up and have their kids say goodbye. The whole family should be there. I've done pickups where there's been four generations of a family saying goodbye to that pet, and I just love that so much.
Yeah. I just have to say, as a personal note, I'm not a big dog person per se. We got dogs because I had little boys at the time, and we thought it was really good for them, and they loved the five dogs that we had over time. I had them about 20 years, you know, different times, five different ones. I go back to those two boys, knew me. I mean, they no judgments. When I got home from work, they were so excited to see me, and they just hung with me no matter where I went, working in the yard, whatever. Everywhere I went, they followed me around. It was just an amazing, you think sometimes they know you better than you do. And it's pretty, and always positive, always wagging their tail, always having fun. So
absolutely. So that unconditional love is amazing.
That's probably why we have them. So I just want to talk a little bit. You are a doctor and you are at the University of Arizona and you're a biologist, right?
Yes.
So what kind of work do you do at the U of A? This is your other job, but what do you do at the University of Arizona?
Yeah, so I actually was a cooperative extension specialist for 6 years. I was stationed in Yuma. So I worked in the College of Ag. I was the food safety extension specialist for the state of Arizona. Mm-hmm. And I decided to move out of academia further into animal welfare. I was an animal shelter director, and I had left here for a little bit, but Tucson called me back, just like it does for a lot of people. Yeah. And I had to make a decision about where I was going to live, and Tucson is it. It's the only place I've ever left and come back to.
That's great.
So yeah, and so now they took me back as an adjunct professor at the College of Public Health.
Oh, great, great. And that might build from there. You know, you got your foot in the door now, as they say, your camel nose under the tent, and that might blossom into something else for you down the line. But in the meantime, you're doing two tracks. You're doing this this other project with taking care of older and care. You said that yourself that you have a couple of animals with you right now. How many do you have?
Oh, so in the rescue, right, there are 86 animals.
86 animals,
yes,
that you're taking care of.
A lot of mouths to feed in the morning.
Yeah, and these are animals that are special needs or older or have something, and they're facing maybe the end of their life, and you're compassionately taking care of them.
Absolutely. They are in the last chapter of their lives, either due to, you know, an injury, a trauma, or, you know, just old age. And we take them in, take good care of them. And, you know, we recently had a dog named Chewy that we took in. We only had him for 4 days. But let me tell you, we conquered that bucket list of his.
That's great. That's great. So if someone was listening to you and wanted one to maybe get some help with an aging pet and they can't take care of him anymore, or if they wanted to kind of talk about what to do with the loss of a pet, how can they find out more about you and where to go and how to get a hold of you?
Yeah, absolutely. They can go to choyaafterlife.com. That has lots of information, all of the packages we have. They can also go to oldsouls.org.
Okay.
And they can find my contact information at either of those. I'm happy to talk to anyone about end of life. Just keep in mind, I'm not a veterinarian, so I can't give veterinary advice, but I can definitely help emotionally and give suggestions about taking your pet to the vet and things like that. And we do offer help through Old Souls for people who have aging pets or hospice pets. If they can't financially get the care that they need, then we have a pocket of money that we do help the community take care of those animals, because we would much rather have them stay at home with someone who loves them.
Right. And we live in southern Arizona, and we speak Spanish part of the time. We also speak Italiano, para rivedenera. Well, but we also speak Spanish and Choya for those people that need to know how to spell it. It's Choella, Choya Afterlife. So if you look that up on the web, you can get a hold of Dr. Paula and find out some more. So taking care of aged pets, especially as you get older, and it's difficult for you to administer medicine or to, you know, do what needs to be done with an older aging pet. I can, or if they have some special needs or something, I can see how this service would be, although difficult to hand over to your pet to a rescue, better than not being able to take care of them. So this is a really powerful tool as well, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, if people just, they need to know that help is out there. So they should call and ask for help. We work with PAC a lot, with Pima Animal Care Center. Almost all of our animals come from there. They're always overcrowded. And there's just, there's a lot of social issues surrounding mm-hmm. that and hoarding and things like that. And so we do take a lot of cases from PAC, and we love when people call us to get the information, because some people don't even know that there is pet support center right. at PAC. So we're right. able to share that information.
And a lot of people, when they're going to get their own pet from a place like PAC, they would tend to go for the puppies and the kittens and the early life and kind of want to spend some time with them. Very few go to a shelter like PAC and try to get a pet that's been alive for 14 years and has a couple months left. They probably wouldn't do that. So yeah. This is a really important service that you provide. So thank you for doing that. Well, good luck to you. And who knows, maybe a little more excitement at the University of Arizona for you. And thanks for taking care of our pets. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Paula Rivadeneira from Choya Afterlife. We'll be back after the break with Andy Motzkin from Caruso's Restaurant, where we're having our next eat and greet celebrating Morgan's time here at the Morning Voice. We'll be back after the break. Good morning and welcome back to the Morning Voice. This is where we talk about success on Fridays. We talk about success in business and wonder at the University of Arizona. We kind of bridge that here with this guest, because not only are they successful, they're also affiliated in a remote kind of a way with the University of Arizona. So welcome to the Morning Voice, Andy Motzkin. How are you?
I'm well. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Andy is the vice president and general manager of one of my favorite places to go, Caruso's Italian Restaurant on 4th Avenue. So we were just talking. We want to keep you engaged in this process for a minimum of 7 years so that we can get you to your centennial anniversary. You've been in business in Tucson for 93 years. That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Extremely amazing. Most restaurants.
2 to 3 years.
Two to three, five, maybe six. Yeah. 10 is great.
Yeah.
And 93 is a long time.
So tell us a little bit of the history of the Zagonia family and how it all got started in the 30s and its progression, and how Sal Sr. and how Whitey, Sal Jr. and yourself now have carried on the legacy. So kind of give us the progression of how the restaurant started and how it got to today.
The restaurant was started by my great-grandfather, Nicasio, and he ran the restaurant for several years, many years, mm-hmm. and his sons, Vince.
And it wasn't at the location it's at now, was that
no,
another location?
No, it was a couple of doors down on the corner, like where the thrift store is.
Thrift store, right, yeah.
And it flooded a couple monsoons in a row. He wasn't familiar with Tucson's monsoon season,
right.
and that was lower ground, and it flooded a few times. And he
moved up to the foothills, four doors down. Yeah,
four doors down made a huge difference.
Yeah,
and we've been there ever since. So for about 2 to 3 years, it was down the road,
right.
south on the block, and then. Yeah, just a few doors up. It's been there ever since.
And people who know you, probably in the 40s and 50s, that beautiful neon sign that's out in front of your place, it's kind of an iconic sign in the Tucson landscape. And so Sal Zagonia, who was the son, took it over, right? He was...
Salvador Sr., yeah. yes, took it over, and... this was his moonlight job,
right.
because he was... professor at the U of A, yeah, for his daytime job.
Yeah, that's the connection. Sal Sr. was a longtime professor at the University of Arizona, going to work during the day at the school and doing all of his teaching and research that they do there, and then coming down to the restaurant at night and being part of the...
For many, many, many years, yeah. yes.
And then his son, Sal Jr.
Correct.
Who we know as Whitey, carried on the family legacy for a while.
For a very long time.
Yeah. I know I asked you how you got involved. You said I was born into the family, so that's how you got involved. You were inducted immediately when you were born. But so your great-grandfather, you're his great-granddaughter, and Sal Sr. was your great-uncle. Is that how?
Yes.
Yeah. 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 And so you are an extended part of the family, but you're the part of the family that has continued. How long have you been there?
2007 I've been there, but... something that people may have not connected is my grandfather owned Vince's
right.
on Speedway. So if you're a longtime Tucsonan, I actually grew up in that restaurant.
Right.
So since I was an infant.
So Sal and your uncle were brothers.
My grandfather.
Your grandfather.
And
I'm
Sal
sorry.
Senior were brothers. Yes.
He's your great uncle. Yeah.
Yes.
So your grandfather and Sal Senior were brothers.
Correct.
And
they each had a restaurant.
Yeah, they each had a restaurant, competing a little bit, but un poquito. Yeah.
Keep it competitive in the family.
That's fantastic. And so, you know, we talk about the copper pot and things, but what then? Caruso sauce, of course. Oh my gosh, I asked if I could inject the salad dressing into my veins when I was down there the other night with my family. It's delicious. Salad dressing is to die for, and the Caruso sauce. I had a delicious meal. What does make Caruso so different and so special from other restaurants?
Well, I think that we try to keep the ingredients quality. The recipes are my great-grandfather's recipes. Some of them have been developed, and the newer dishes have been developed by the family. But the quality of the ingredients and the integrity of the food, and continuing with the old-school way of making food, trying not to use modern processes, I think makes us a little different than other restaurants. You know, we could, of course, simplify things and buy already made items, but we hand make nearly probably 90% of everything that we serve.
Right. And I like to talk about hyperbole, since I'm in marketing and advertising. Hyperbole is beyond with me. But I talk about the copper pot. You've had a pot that you've been making Caruso sauce in for 93 years, it seems like. And that's kind of the fun part of it, the tradition. And if anybody's been down to Caruso's, you know, you don't have a 2045 modern robotic AI kitchen.
No.
You are working out of a kitchen that was out of the 30s and kind of expanded it. And so it's kind of an extended little pods that are kind of all connected together, and salads in one area and entrees in another area and desserts in another area, but it all kind of comes together. And that's the kitchen is kind of on the north side of the building, and then the big dining rooms are on the other side. So just the restaurant itself, which used to be probably in the 20s and 30s, was an old home, right?
Yes.
And so you've added a patio on the back and some extended buildings on the north side and so forth. So it's taking an old 4th Avenue home and building it up. So one of the unique things that you have there is you're on 4th Avenue, and so you obviously open up right onto the avenue. The streetcar drops right off in front of you, which, you know, one could argue, a politician like me, what could argue that why'd we spend, you know, $125 million on a streetcar, but it's nice that it stops right in front of your place.
Yeah, we have a stop right in front.
Yeah, and that, you know, 4th Avenue just has been known for being difficult to park, but it's easily accessible. Ironically, when I came down the other day with my family, we pulled up right in front of the restaurant. We were right in front of the front door, and so you can find a place to park down there. It's pretty easy. The access is easy, and if you take the Sunlink, it drops you off. Basically, you get about 10 steps and you're into the front door of Caruso. So it's been probably challenging over the years to, you don't have a restaurant that has a 500-car parking lot out in front of it. And so it's a little intimidating for some people, but I'm here to say it's not that intimidating. It's kind of neat to walk down 4th Avenue and be part of that whole thing. Tell us a little bit about some of the dishes you serve. Obviously, traditional Italian food, but you're also big into pizza, right?
We do pizza. It's different than most. It's kind of almost a cracker crust. It is the recipe, again, from my great-grandfather, Sicilian style, kind of. They tend to like some crunchy food, right. So the pizza is delicious. It's all handmade. Again, what a great team I have teaching them and having them learn these skills. Everything is handmade. All the cheese blend is blended by us. The sauce is homemade. All the ingredients are chopped by us. We don't buy it pre-cut. And it seems crazy, but it does make a difference.
It does.
It really does.
Freshness is just amazing. And you can, I know this sounds trite, but you can literally taste the freshness in the food, which is amazing.
Yes.
I I say you have the best salad in town. It comes on a cold plate, a metal plate, and it's the lettuce is cold and the dressing is to die for. It's an amazing thing. I could just eat your salads all day long. They're absolutely delicious. And I do because they come with bread, and the garlic bread is also to die for. And I have been known to come to your place and order an entree, eat the bread and the salad and take the entree home because I'm full by the time the entree shows up.
You're not the only one.
Yeah. It's amazing. That bread that comes in those baskets, you can't bring enough of those to me. That's just absolutely delicious. So,
thank you.
Well, when we come back, Andy, we'll talk a little bit more about the legacy of Caruso's on 4th Avenue. And we've got an event coming up on the 20th. We'll talk a little bit about our eat and greet, which is scheduled at Caruso's in a couple of weeks. So you're listening to The Morning Voice on KVOI Radio. We'll be back with some Italiano in honor of the Pope. Italiano. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. Our favorite Italian restaurant in Tucson and maybe the world is Caruso's on 4th Avenue. Hey, we're going to have a eat and greet. You're going to be able to meet Lydia, Ted, Grant, Tom, and myself, and Matt will be there. We're going down to Caruso's on the 20th, which is a Tuesday. We're going to be there at 5:30 to 7 out on the patio probably. I don't know. It depends on how hot it's going to be. If it's 150 degrees, we'll be inside. if it's a decent evening, we might be out on the patio depending on the weather. But we'd invite you to come on down and be part of our third eat and greet at Caruso's on 4th Avenue and take a look at their website and look at all the wonderful dishes they have available. And you can buy something and have a bottle of red or a bottle of white with us and enjoy Caruso's on 4th Avenue. With us is the Vice President and General Manager of Caruso's. She's been there since 2007, Andy Motzkin. Again, good morning to you, Andy.
Good morning.
Andy and I are two peas in a pod. I have a sister. Her name is Andy, and it's spelled the exact same way, A-N-D-E. And so there's not many Andys in the world, and two of the most wonderful ones are in my life, and I think that's fantastic. So
thank you.
So you're in charge, and you have memories of Vince's and memories of Caruso's and so forth, and then you went away for a while and did some work in the medical field and that kind of stuff. But then you came back in 2007. What's a memorable moment or story about either your great uncle or your just being part of the family and even back to Vince's or whatever about growing up in an Italian restaurant and an Italian family, a big Italian family. What do you remember? What are some a story maybe?
Some of the best memories are. Well, we're food-centric, obviously. Right. So some of the best memories is watching my elders cook and explain and talk. And it wasn't just about food or feeding. It's about love. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my husband had a neon sign made for me that says, we love when we feed people, we are loving them, and it's just listening to them and the passion that they exude when they're cooking. And you know, they'd make it a whole team sport, the whole you know, everybody be sitting talking, or you know, just
talking at the same time, right?
All talking, yelling, I should say. We're Italian. We yell, we're loud. Yeah. And suddenly we're all in the kitchen trying to put our hands in the sauce, you know, and it sometimes turned into food fights or it still does. My kids are great cooks, and their partners thank me all the time because they don't cook at all.
Right.
So
right,
they always call and say, thank you for passing that along.
That's great.
But just the passion in which they... I mean, they could be making a hot dog, and it turns into a masterpiece. So I just always remember that.
Well, you know, it is interesting. You've hit on something that's really important. After 93 years, it's important that nothing against nationwide chains or worldwide restaurants and so forth, which all have their place and are all wonderful, and we like to go to them as well. It's the fact that this is a family enterprise and that the love is there, and you can feel it when you walk in the door, and you can taste it when you eat the delicious food. And I have to admit, we got six desserts, and they were all fantastic, and I had a spoonful of each and every one of them. We had spumoni, we had the sorbet, whatever it is, the Italian ice, and then we had, so my wife had this pistachio cake. She loved it. She thought that was great. So it's just a really fun and enjoyable place to go, and the patio, especially in the spring and fall, is to go outside and sit outside and have a delicious meal outside is also awesome as well. What's the future for Caruso's after almost 100 years? Of course, I want you to stay for another 100 years and do this for the rest of your life and your kids' lives and your kids' kids' lives and forever. But it's interesting how Caruso's has grown over the years and just maintained and kept the same atmosphere and the same family and the same quality and the same just love of doing what you do. That's kind of the way it's going to be for a while anyways, for however long you can see into the future, right?
Yeah, it's forever. It's forever going to be there. Yeah. Well, we wish it would be. I plan on keeping Caruso's going for as long as Tucson will have us.
Right.
It is a legacy, and like you said, it's a huge part of the community.
Mm-hmm.
So many wonderful memories. I think that, you know, every day I'll check in and to a doctor's office and fill out the forms,
right,
and they see where I work, and I get the best stories. Some so funny, some heartfelt, some so silly, you know, and some not so great. I had a friend break up with his partner at my restaurant, and it was her first time being there. I could have killed him.
You know, there was a gentleman that lived in our neighborhood. He and his brother, they would sneak down to Caruso's a couple of times a week, and you know, they lived on the east side where we live, but he would make his way down there, and we used to go down there and see him all the time. He's not going, haven't seen him down there lately, but I was just to laugh with him that you know, most guys go to the bar, or the golf course, or someplace like that. He'd sneak down with his brother to Caruso's and enjoy, and do it two or three or four times a day, a week.
We have a few of those.
Yeah, just loved the atmosphere. I'll tell you one guy that loved Caruso's, and I can honestly say, towards the end of his life, it was his favorite place to go, and that was my dad.
We love to have your dad there.
He would come down and get a glass of white wine, and he would sip it ever so properly, and then he was great. So you have a wonderful restaurant, carusositalian.com, and come down and visit and come see us on the 20th, right?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, come down this weekend if you want to. Andy Motzkin, your joy, and love having you on the show and love being affiliated with you and your family.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This is The Morning Voice on KVOI. Prego. Prego.
University of Arizona Wonder Stories coming up right after the news. Stay tuned for The Morning Voice.
Good morning and welcome to The Morning Voice. This is U of A Wonder, where we celebrate the wonderful things going on at the University of Arizona. I had a good fortune yesterday to have breakfast with the president of the university, Dr. Suresh Garamella. It was my first time that I had a personal meeting with him. It was great. He's got a great vision for the future. You know, I was a big fan of Bobby Robbins and how he came in and did his thing for 7 years. I'm really excited about what President Garamella is going to be doing and his focus on communication and all the things that he wants to do. And hey, we're starting July 1st without a deficit, and he's already been able to repair some of that financial situation that the university was in. So a lot of good things happening at the University of Arizona. One of those good things that's happening at the University of Arizona is graduation. It starts, the finals are this coming week, and then next Friday, Saturday will be graduation ceremonies, and one of those people that's graduating is Morgan Murphy, and congratulations to you, Morgan, on your master's degree and all the good work you've done at the U of A over the last 5 years.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So one of your favorite professors at the University of Arizona was?
Well, of course you.
Okay, I like that part.
But also Professor Brent Marinen. Who happens to be on the show with us today.
Yes. Well, good morning, Brent, and welcome to The Morning Voice.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me today. I didn't know that, Morgan. But I appreciate that.
Of course.
Well, Brent, it's tough to teach with you because you are always getting the teacher of the year and the most favorite teacher and the most wonderful guy. So I appreciate all you do in the department. And we're going to talk a little bit about the marketing minor experience, but we'll talk a little bit about some other things first. So let's just talk first, Brent, about how you got to the University of Arizona. You were in industry and then had an export business, and then you came over to the university. So tell us a little bit about your experience before you got to the U of A.
So a bit of my background before I got to university. The short version is that I started in academia, getting an undergraduate degree in economics from a university in West Philadelphia, the University of Pennsylvania. After graduating college, I actually tried to play professional golf for 5 years.
Right.
Didn't quite make it though. Not quite at the level of what you see on television, but learned a lot. After that, I founded an export company that you mentioned, did that for 8 years, sold that. After that, I did take some time off, kind of had to figure out what I wanted to do next. And when I built my company, I saw that the world was moving more to data in making business decisions. So I thought, let's try educating myself in the world of data. And so I ended up in the statistics graduate program here at the U of A. And from there, never really with any aspirations to teach, I somehow began teaching undergraduate statistics classes at the U of A's business school, the Eller College of Management. And this is where I met gifted speakers like yourself and other extremely intelligent people and decided, hey, I might enjoy hanging around the university environment for a while. So I did, and I've hung around here now at the U of A, where I've been a lecturer for about 8 years.
That's great. And you started kind of over in the statistics side of things, and then we grabbed you over into marketing, and you've been a marketing instructor for quite a while now. And now we have the brand new, Yang Liu was the first department chair. We have a brand new, I say it's brand new, it's about a year and a half old now, the business analytics program, and you've moved from marketing over to be one of the first instructors over specifically in the business analytics program. So tell us a little bit about what business analytics is and what you do in your new role as an instructor for, it's kind of the same thing you're doing, but now it's under the business analytics program.
Yeah, a great question. So business analytics is about using data to make smarter decisions in business, right? It's like being a detective for a business, looking at numbers, patterns, trends to try and solve problems, or spot certain opportunities. And you don't have to be a math genius, but you do need to be able to use tools like Excel, Python, or dashboards to really kind of turn messy data into something useful and actionable. The business analytics program itself is designed to be deeply integrated with core business functions, you know, especially marketing. It equips students with the skills to analyze data, identify trends, identify patterns, and try to make evidence-based decisions, really kind of scientific decisions that drive strategic business outcomes. And so marketing, for example, will try to help answer questions like which customer segments are the most profitable, or how do pricing changes affect sales across regions. For somebody like yourself, Ed, in creative, it might answer what type of ad campaigns deliver the highest return on investment. Maybe a customer lifetime value analysis, or best performing channels, maybe predicting which ad copy will lead to higher engagement. Do some channels amplify other channels? And so we do this by introducing business analytics students to real world data sets. And these data sets are supplied by companies like like the Nielsen ratings. Mm-hmm. So that's essentially the business analytics.
Great. And the new department is sponsored by, or underwritten, I guess is the better word, by Umberto and Zarina Lopez, the HSL Properties Group. And Yang Lu was the first director. He's kind of double dipping. He's over he was our department chair for marketing. Then he moved over to business analytics, dual appointment in marketing, and now he's up in the dean's office, managing some initiatives for the dean. But the department is moving along quickly. It's a small department right now with just a couple of instructors and a couple of people, but there's a lot of big things happening on the horizon for business analytics, and you're one of the first full-time instructors for the department. But how do you see the department growing over the next few years in terms of the types of things, maybe master's programs and even doctoral programs down the line, of where as we move into more and more reliance on data, how important this business analytics program is to the future of marketing management and success for business?
Yes. First of all, we're definitely very thankful for Mr. Lopez's contribution in founding this school. And I never thought of it as I'm like kind of one of the first instructors, but I guess that's true. I do always tell my undergraduate students that they should be excited about being the first students to graduate from the business analytics school. And I guess thinking about it as one of the first instructors, I guess I'm excited myself. But yeah, business analytics is, so in every department, there is an analytics mix. And essentially what we've done is we built this group right now of 4 instructors. We're going to be making it 5 in the fall, and hoping to be able to serve all of the different departments throughout the university. I'm sorry, throughout the Eller Business College of Management, and grow. Right now in our first class, I believe we have of undergraduate students in our first year, we have 11 students. I just looked at the enrollment for the summer programming course. We have 14 students coming in. In the fall, we have 25 more students coming in. So it's growing quickly. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, we have the support of the university, and we have the support of very gracious donors like Umberto Lopez.
Yeah, in my meeting with the president yesterday morning, he was all about data, talking about how data is what drives us. Data drives us in our decision-making and even financial data, but he was quoting enrollment data and retention data and grade point averages and moving on to careers and where students are landing, and then talked a lot about the data around research and about the financial things happening from Washington, D.C. and the state. And you know, honestly, 60% of what we talked about was data. And it's really an important part of managing data. If you're a president of a university, a billion-dollar university, it's data is king. And it's important that we have this department now able to teach students maybe more in-depth about data and business analytics. And so it's an important part of what we're doing in the Eller College.
It is, yes. And when I was with my export company growing it, I had very, very little knowledge of data. And it really wasn't until I sold the company and I looked at what was happening on the landscape and found that, yes, companies were moving to making their strategic decisions on a more scientific method. Right. And that's really what kind of drew me to begin to study data.
Great. Well, when we come back after the break, we're going to talk with Brent Martin about the Summer Marketing Minor Program at the U of A, which he directs. And he's in business analytics, but he's also our director of the summer program. So we'll come back after the break. You're listening to KVOI 1030 AM, and this is The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am Dr. Ed Ackerley. During the break, we heard a commercial for Guinness. I just wanted to mention that our good friend John C. Scott, who is the voice of that commercial, passed away about a year ago now. And when he passed away, we talked to Chef Coralie, who is Guinness owner, And then I talked with John's son and said they'd like to keep his voice on the radio commercial. Would that be okay? And I'm honored to have John's voice on Guinness. He helped build their business for about 30 years. And John's son was just really honored to be able to say yes. And so for those people that wonder why John's voice is still on the Guinness commercial, it's because he was a great advocate of theirs, and they were longtime partners. And we're just honored to have Guinness as a sponsor here of the Morning Voice, and to have John's voice. That's pretty good, isn't it, Matt, to have John's voice?
Absolutely,
still.
It's great to hear him.
Yeah, it's great. To hear he's him. Great. So, on the line with us is Brent Martin. He is the business analytics program at the Eller College, the new department that is using data to serve the entire college, management, MIS, finance, accounting, marketing, all the different departments that we have at the Eller College. In his night job, he runs the marketing minor program during the summer. And so we have over 100 undergraduates who will be starting in just about a week and a half to have a six-class experience, actually seven, because some of them have to take a prerequisite, a seven-class experience during the summer. So, Brent, tell us a little bit about the marketing minor, and you're the director of that. You're still over in marketing, even though you're now with business analytics, you've continued on as our director of the summer marketing minor program. So can you explain a little bit about that program and who that serves?
Yeah, sure. So before I talk about the program, as you know, as a lecturer yourself, you do have 80% teaching and 20% of service to the university. So I wanted to keep my service within the marketing department, even though I'm officially appointed in the business analytics program. And yes, my service is as the director of the summer marketing minor program. But yeah, the summer marketing minor program is a fairly intense, accelerated program designed for non-business majors who want to develop fundamental marketing skills that essentially complement their field of study. It's open to undergraduate students from across the university. We're talking about psychology, communications, information sciences, journalism. We even have a couple dance majors. So it's a pretty wide range. Basically, it's for any student that is looking to get some practical career-ready knowledge in areas like branding, consumer behavior, marketing analytics. So the program runs over the summer in a fairly condensed format, seven courses, like you said. And we start up about 1 month from now, June 9th, and we aim to provide what we're hopeful for is an immersive experience of hands-on projects, sprinkled in with some theory and real-world case studies. I know they get a lot of that in your sales class, Ed. Mm-hmm. And we feel it's very, very valuable for students who will eventually be entering the business world, but really don't have any academic experience in it yet. So I like to think that we give them a decent grounding in business, at least from the lens of marketing.
There's a couple of points I'd like to make. One is that some of these majors, like communications is a good example, require that the student get a minor in somewhere, do something in the minor area. And so it obviously makes perfect sense to have a communication major come over and do a marketing minor. It's a great marriage of two different disciplines that are very similar in what they're doing. I also thought it was interesting. I think this was during Dr. Liu's, when he was head of the department, he kind of made the decision in consulting with the faculty and so forth that these students that are coming from all over the university are coming to the Eller College for this intense experience during the summer, and they get to graduate. They get to call themselves Eller graduates after that because they do have a minor now. So it does expand the footprint of our regular majors and master's degrees and doctoral students who are coming out of the Eller College. We now have a contingent of young people who are from across the university who have this marketing minor and then can call themselves Eller graduates. And I personally have had several over the years, maybe 20 or 30% of our ad team, which is our National Student Advertising Competition team, come into that annual competition as being marketing minors and not the marketing majors that we teach during the regular spring and fall semesters. So it's been really great to have these students from all over the university align with the marketing department and do this. So you talked about real world experience, the capstone class at the end of the whole seven. Reason I said it starts Monday is I start a week from Monday with the seventh class, which is the prerequisite. Some of the students still have to take a prerequisite, so I get to start a little bit early in the thing. June 9th is when the actual sixth class program starts. But tell us a little bit, Brent, about the Battle of the Brands and what that is and how that's the capstone for this summer program.
Great question. The Battle of Brands. And you might know better, Ed, given your longtime involvement in the minor program, but I believe that name was crafted by a former director of the minor program. I think it was Tanya, maybe?
Correct.
Anyways, the Battle of Brands is a team-based competition within the marketing minor program where students apply what they've learned throughout this 9-week program to create and pitch a full marketing campaign for a real-world product. It's held at the end of the program and serves as, like you said, a capstone experience. Teams develop a full marketing strategy, which usually includes a target segmentation, positioning of the product, some creative messaging, digital tactics, social tactics, and sometimes even some mock-up ads. Anyways, the final deliverable is a pitch or a formal presentation, and the presentations are judged by leaders in industry, also some faculty and their peers. So yeah, teams, they do compete for these fun awards and recognition, but the real value for them, I feel, is in the collaboration, the creativity, and the real world storytelling. The goal for this Battle of the Brands is essentially to synthesize everything from the program into a compelling, persuasive brand strategy. And this helps build students' confidence, presentation skills, and ultimately a team experience. And actually, for many of the students, this really is their first time working with a team, which, as you know, is obviously a very important skill set to have in business. So I know you, Ed, as a core member of the Minors Program's faculty, people like Sangeeta Venkatarami, another faculty member, are very, very instrumental in helping make this Battle of Brands a success through the recruiting of industry folks and the logistics of this competition. So that's the Battle of Brands, yes.
And this summer we have over 100 students already enrolled in the program, so we hope to give them an experience of a lifetime in business and so forth, turn some of them on to marketing as a possible career down the line. So, Brent, you've been at the U of A for a long time. You've been a golf pro. You've been an industry importer-exporter guy and making money in the real world. What's your favorite thing about being a faculty member at the University of Arizona?
Solid question. I've had a lot of great experiences as a faculty member, watching students grow from, you know, uncertain learners into confident, capable professionals, is pretty neat to see. And I'm sure you have a lot of familiarity with that, Ed. Mm-hmm. In terms of one experience, probably the most recent was this past summer. I was teaching a Python programming course to graduate students, in our business analytics program. And we were all in the same boat, getting up daily for a 5-hour class that started at 8 a.m. Anyways, it was a very, very fun, engaging class. And one morning I brought in my dog during a break in the class, and they appreciated that. Anyways, fast forward to the last day of class, and they gave me a signed card thanking me for teaching them, and then gave me a stuffed animal that was a Python, so my dog could play with that. So I think experiences like this are what really keep me excited about teaching. And I know you've had a lot of experiences with students like this as well.
Yeah, it's a great career, and we can impact people's lives, young people's lives, and that's important. So, Brent, thank you for being with us this morning. Brent Marnin, he is the director of the Summer Marketing Minor Program, a faculty member in the Business Analytics Project at the University of Arizona. And thanks for all the good work you do with our students at the University of Arizona. You're listening to The Morning Voice, sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I got carried away talking to my good friend, Dr. Chris Segrin, who is the department chair for the Department of Communication and the Social and Behavior Sciences Department at the University of Arizona. So good morning, Dr. Segrin.
Good morning, Ann. It's great to be with you.
We were talking about some internal things. I had a little breakfast with the president yesterday, and we had a little party for you and the communication department. Let them eat cake, as they say, because we were recognizing your tenure as the department head for the Department of Communications. Before we talk a little bit about that, how did you get to the university so many years ago, and how did you become a head of a department at the university?
I came to the University of Arizona almost by accident, just a fortuitous event. I was working as a professor at the University of Kansas. One of my graduate students from Kansas, who did her master's degree there, came to U of A to do her PhD. I was talking to her on the phone, and she said, you know, we have a job opening here in Arizona. And, you know, it was just this, a short conversation like that where it came up. She asked me if I'd be willing to apply, put me in touch with her advisor. Well, you know, the rest is history. So it was kind of a unplanned, happy accident almost.
That's great. And you've been, we were talking off air that you've been the department chair in the Department of Communication and the Social and Behavior Sciences College at the university for, goodness gracious, 22 years. And so,
correct.
And kind of a milestone, because not many department chairs hang as the department chair for that long a time. So that's a kind of unique in your situation to be a department chair for that length of time.
It is unusual. Typically, department chairs serve 5-year terms. Sometimes they'll renew for another term. And, you know, the long timers are doing 10 years. And somehow I got sucked into this vortex for 22.
You know, I met you, goodness gracious, now it's probably been 15 years ago when we were talking, and I asked you to come over and we just had Brent on, our summer marketing minor. And you came over for several years to speak to my summer marketing minor students about the fidelity in communications and all the wonderful things that you talk about, the future of communications, I called it. And you're still doing that. You'll be doing it this summer again for us. And 3 or 4 or 5 years into that, you said, you know, you need to come over here to our communications department and do some of this stuff you're doing at Eller. Could you do that for us? So I've enjoyed a great relationship with the communication department over the last several years, teaching two classes, and one is communication and leadership, and the other is professional creative communication. And wow, it's been fun. What a wonderful group of students. I got one class I just finishing up, 72 students in it. They're pretty engaged in the process. They are really good students and good people. So you've done a good job of growing the program.
Thank you very much. It has been just an unbelievably fortunate situation to be affiliated with a discipline that's had historically just a huge demand from students.
Right.
Students who come to U of A and American universities in general seem hungry for knowledge of human communication, how to improve their communication, how to dispatch those skills in an employment setting, and connecting with people. That's really what communication's all about. And we've been very fortunate to have that big demand for so many years.
Yeah, I don't know if they told you, but they went ahead and added a second section of my fall class now, because there's so much demand. And so I'm teaching two sections of that class. So thank you for that. Hey, I've been at the U of A long enough, and you've been there long enough. Learning has changed, and the way we deliver and how we teach and even the research that we do has changed a little bit. How have students changed for you, or have they changed? Maybe they're the same student that they were 22 years ago, but how have students changed in your lifetime?
When I started in this business, being a student meant a different set of behaviors. You know, I think young people, our young people, and they've, you know, they have their goals and ambitions and aspirations, and that hasn't changed a whole lot. However, the way they behave, the way they learn has changed. You know, we literally, in the, as recently as the 1990s, Ed, students were coming to class, as you know, with notebooks and pads of paper and a pencil.
And textbooks too, hard copy textbooks.
Yeah. They would bring textbooks and open the book. Now it's laptops and phones, you know, cell phones and tablets. And, you know, there's a lot of, with the connectivity, there's a lot of alternative distractions that can become available. So these are, you know, really useful tools, these laptops and tablets, but they have to be used responsibly, and sometimes they can become a distraction. So the biggest change, I think, is rooted in the use of technology as part of the learning process.
Right. I have a, you know, my biggest pet peeve. I've been here at the U of A way too long, I guess. My biggest pet peeve is the lack of engagement and the looking at your laptop full time while someone's you know, trying to talk to you and give a presentation and so forth. So you know, I've been doing this almost 3.5 decades now, and I always preach to the choir and the people that are in the room, and those that aren't, I hope they get the message. You know, you got to use your laptop for the right reasons, and don't be looking up the sports score or your trip to New Zealand or whatever you're doing on your laptop. You know, focus and be focused. And I go on and on about this, and because it's a professional skill, I think they need to learn when they're in a professional setting, they need to be focused on what they're doing. And the class left, and this one young lady from communications walked up to me and said, "Dr. Ackerley, you're one of the best teachers I've ever had. You're great. Love your class. Love all. I've taken another class from you. You're wonderful." And she said this: "You got to quit worrying about the people who are disengaged in the process and teach those of us that are engaged." And after she said that about 3 or 4 years ago, I've just really kind of focused on those students that are paying the money and want to be there and learn from me, and let the rest of it kind of fall where it falls. And so as technology has grown, I've had to adjust my teaching style. I'm sure you have too as well.
Yes.
Dr. Siegman, you were as the head of the communications department, then you went in over to SBA, over into leadership for a little bit, and then came back doing a dual role and coming back over to communication again. We have a new president and a new provost coming on in about 2 weeks here after commencement. From the University of, she's the president right now, the University of Vermont. She follows President Garamella from the University of Vermont and is going to be the provost. You've been here a long time. What are the challenges and opportunities for the U of A in the coming year?
I think some of the challenges faced at U of A are both regional as well as national. And in both cases, unfortunately, for very different reasons, regionally and nationally, the support for higher education is not all that it used to be. And sometimes, you know, in states like Vermont or Oregon, where there's more of a stronger ethos about supporting higher education, that translates into funding, you know, where state governments are willing to help finance the education of the populace. And in our state, that sentiment isn't quite as strong. And what that means is that the university has got to find ways to manage itself financially without relying on state subsidies. So that's a local problem that some states have and others don't. All states have experienced decreases in funding over the last 20, 30 years from their state government, but it's been fairly pronounced in Arizona. So that's one challenge. And it's a kind of an Arizona-centric challenge in some ways that they'll have to confront. Of course, we also have a major, major issue going on right now nationally, whereby, you know, higher education and universities are frankly being looked down upon by some echelons of our society, where it used to be that going to college, going to university was just an aspiration of so many people. And now you have people who are actually turning away from that and feeling that that's not in their best interest. And that is a threat not only to the health and welfare of universities, but to the larger society. You know, we feel that, you know, an educated populace is generally a good thing for society. And if our society starts losing that ground, that could be problematic. And that is a challenge. And I offer this to you with no political dog in any fight. This is not, to me, this is not a conservative or liberal issue. This is a national issue about, you know, what kind of nation do we want to have, regardless of which camp you pitch your tent at. And so the presidents of all universities in America have a lot of messaging to do to set the record straight on what it is that we do, and not to get caught up in what sometimes makes for really good news stories because they're flashy, a protest with police on campus and whatnot. I mean, that's not a reflection of the totality of what university life is all about.
That's one of the reasons we started Wonder and talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. As I was telling the president yesterday, you know, we can have news stories about budget fights and new hires of coaches and transitions and all sorts of different things, and even some crime and some negative stories come out, and certainly they make the local news. But 9,000 things are going on today at the University of Arizona that are affecting our community, but also our nation and our world in a positive way. And we need to tell those stories as well and communicate that information as well. So you're right on with your analysis there. When we come back after the break, I want to talk to you a little bit about your own research in communication and the human experience. You're listening to KVOI 1030 AM, and this is The Morning Voice. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. We're with Dr. Chris Segrin, who is the outgoing department head for 22 years now of the Communication Department in the College of Social and Behavior Sciences at the University of Arizona. Two quick things, Chris, I just want to say. One is thank you for your personal and professional support of me as I ran for mayor two times. You were most gracious in your support of me academically and letting me keep my job at the U of A while I was trying to run for office. So I thank you for that. And again, just another thank you for inviting me to come over and teach. I've been at the Eller College for about 30, 33, 34 years, something like that. And you invited me to come teach some classes over in communication for you. When I got my career track faculty status with Eller just a couple of years ago, they said, you're doing a good job in communication. Let's let you keep those two appointments. So I thank you for advocating for me in those two areas. So that's just a personal thank you to you for all you've done.
Happy to.
Let's talk a little bit about your research. And you got books coming out and you've got things going on. But you've always been a person that's looking at communication as part of the human experience and interpersonal relationships, including mental health and focus on social skills, relationship development, satisfaction, all those things, and even things like tough things for humans to deal with, such as depression, anxiety, loneliness, and even marital distress. So how's the research going in this area, and what are you working on, and what is your vision for this human experience of communication?
Well, the research on mental health issues really is taking off in what I would call the interpersonal paradigm. In other words, we're really realizing the important role of interpersonal relationships and mental health. So many psychological problems end up, when you really get down to the core of them, having their roots in difficulties with other people. Not all of them, of course, but in many cases. One of the applications I'm working with right now is people who are in treatment or recovering from cancer and their relationships with a family caregiver. It's often a spouse, it may be a parent, it may even be an adult child, and how those relationships help or hinder, in some cases, the recovery and the management of troublesome symptoms that are often experienced during treatment for cancer. What we're realizing is that once you're diagnosed with cancer and you have surgery and you have treatment and they send you home, the journey is hardly over. It's in fact just getting started. And there are lots of issues that have to be addressed. And family members will often play a role in supporting and helping the survivor through this recovery experience. And the nature of those relationships and how they communicate with each other, how they communicate with caregivers and physicians and nurses and oncologists, radiologists, communications ends up being a really important part of that. And it's fascinating as someone outside of oncology to see how they're kind of starting to wrap their arms around the importance of interpersonal communication in that regard. And so I've been very honored to be able to be doing research in this area.
That's great work, and we appreciate all the good things you're doing, especially with Banner and the U of A health system and all of that going on, and the great work that's being happening over at north of Speedway. Last question I have for you has to do with about fidelity. And you have been over to my classes talking about the what we've given up in our lives. Talk a little bit about fidelity and portability.
Well, it turns out that in the 1990s, early 2000s, the use of technology and the influx of technology into our lives was very much geared at creating opportunities for communication in ways that were, as you use the term, portable, highly portable. The cell phone, right? Think about that. It allowed us for the first time to talk to people regardless of where we were, because prior to the cell phone, we literally had a cord connecting the phone to the wall. So this allowed us to move around and talk. And of course, the things like the iPod and so forth allowed us to listen to music anywhere. But this came at a cost, Ed. It involved the loss of fidelity. So suddenly people were watching movies on a smartphone, or they were, when cell phones first came out with cameras, they were degraded image quality compared to what the time was, the 35 millimeter camera. And there has been sort of a trade-off between fidelity, which is rich, you know, immersion in communication and all that it has to offer, and trading that fidelity for portability, something I can take with me anywhere and do it on demand, regardless of where I am, again, with maybe a little sacrifice in quality. What I have talked to students about many times is that the future of communication is going to be, I think, the quest for trying to get that fidelity back into how we interact with other people, again, whether it's interpersonal, organizational, or even mass communication, the kinds of, you know, television and movie experiences we have. Because I do believe that human beings respond positively to fidelity. We like the richness of communication with other people. We'd much rather go watch a movie at an IMAX theater, right, than watch it on a laptop. Yeah. But it's stunning how many people are watching movies right now on their laptop computer.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Chris Segrin, concluding 22 years as the director, department head for the Department of Communication and the Social and Behavior Sciences Department. You've done great work. Good luck on your sabbatical and your books, and we look forward to seeing you back here in about a year as you go back to being, a run-of-the-mill professor in the Communication Department. Thank you for your support. You're listening to The Morning Voice.